Hey guys, this is Steve Horsman again with Good Guys to Great Men. Thanks again for tuning in today. As I told you in a newsletter a week or two ago that I was going to bring a rock star of a relationship coach on with me onto a video call. And I want to introduce to you Mr. Bruce Music. And before I let Bruce talk, I want to talk a little bit about Bruce. Bruce is known as the couple's whisperer. Like sometimes guys are calling me the wife whisperer, but the couple's whisperer. He's built a reputation as a guy relationship counselors refer their toughest clients to help fix troubled marriages. He's an acclaimed writer, a seminar leader, and a coach, and he's known internationally for helping couples repair their romantic relationships and start being happy together. And you know that's what we're all about. And unlike most traditional relationship advisors who advocate learning communication skills, right, communicate better, Bruce believes that couples already know how to communicate, but the trouble, he says, is that most couples have never learned how to stay emotionally connected to each other when the romance stage ends. And a quote that he said that I love is, instead of trying to resolve a couple's relationship issue by talking about them, first I focus on helping a couple connect like they did when they were falling in love. And only then does talking actually resolve anything. You can find Bruce at brucemusic.com or at another free course site called loveatfirstfight.com. That's a great free course. He's done a TEDx talk too as well. Now I just wanted to show you a little bit of information on Bruce. Hold on. Share this screen. This happens all the time. Here he is. And all his goals, this is 2011, right, Bruce?
Could be. I don't actually remember the exact year it happened, but
I've watched this video three or four times, and the opening story starts with you with your mom in a car in South Africa, I think. You guys got to watch that. Just watch that. Anyway, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure. Thank you for that delightful introduction. I'm kind of blushing a little bit on the inside, and I'm always thrilled to have a conversation with you. It's always fun.
I appreciate it. I wanted to briefly tell the guys watching and some of the ladies who subscribe as well that I've been stalking you for a few years and you didn't know it. I've been kind of stalking to you, listening to what your take is on relationships and communication. You're an expert on attachment styles and achieving more intimacy. We talk a lot about intimacy and sex and affection in my group. I had to write down, why was I stalking Bruce? And this is what I wrote down. Bruce is smart, he's sharp, he's got a pragmatic view, but with tons of emotional depth and intellectual nuance. I find you incredibly clear when you speak, and you're also unapologetic in what you believe and how you serve people. And the thing I love most about you is that what comes through every time I see you on video, you care, you give so much of a shit, it blows my mind. And this is why I'm paying attention to you. And let you guys know, Bruce is an advocate for the relationship. You know, I coach men only, but Bruce helps both partners understand the path to better connection and how to improve their roles in creating safety with each other. As you know, I specifically focus on the man's relationship with himself and then his relationship. But we have a whole lot in common, as you'll find out when we keep going. So there you go.
Thanks for that intro, Steve. That's moving. And actually, it's lovely hearing your perception of me, somebody I respect, feeding back to me how you see me. Thank you. I'm flattered.
You're welcome. Can I ask you a question?
Go. I'm all yours.
You got this quote. The first thing you see when you get on your website is this quote that says that anything that is not love is a misunderstanding. And at first you go, oh, that's great. And you go, what the fuck does that mean? I love that. So my first question is, what's a real life example of this concept in action in a struggling relationship?
Great. So anything that isn't love is a misunderstanding. And what I mean by that is that after having worked with about 1,600 people now with their relationships, I've gotten very used to hearing one side of the story, and somebody tells me about how bad their relationship is and their spouse does this and this and this, and they list out all the things. And, you know, I can't even take sides anymore because I know what's going to happen. The minute I speak to the other spouse, I'm going to hear the other side of the story, and it's going to be a completely different and equally valid side to the story. And when we dig into it, we'll find out that their whole upset is just a misunderstanding every time. And I'll give you an example. So I was working with this couple, Jay and Mandy, And they came to me, they were in trouble. Jay, the last thing he had done that really, you know, freaked Mandy out was he had smashed a chair to pieces, one of their dinner table chairs to pieces in front of her. He was so mad. And she was complaining about how he had anger issues and da 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 da. And when we got into it, turns out Mandy had recently started her own business. Kids left home, started her own business. She was working from home a lot after hours to try build her business. And Jay was feeling like he didn't get any of her attention anymore. And he had tried to reach her several times to let her know that he was feeling insecure, that he was struggling. But she just saw all his advances as annoying interruptions when she was really meant to be focusing after work on building her business after her normal job hours. Right. And so she had snapped back at him every time. And after a while, he asked her to clean the house with him. And she was like, do I really need to clean the house with you? Is this really necessary? And he got so angry, he just smashed the chair and broke it. Now, if you look at it as an isolated incident, he looks like, you know, he might even be abusive. He has anger issues. But if you see it in the context of this has been building up for 6 months and he was so insecure, he loved her so damn much, and she couldn't see his pleas for connection. She just missed them all the time. And so she kept getting annoyed by him trying to go, help, I need you, I miss you, I'm afraid I'm going to lose you. In the end, he was so scared. Like most of us, we cover up our fear with anger. Yeah. He smashed a chair. And when she could see that his anger was because he loved her so much and he was so afraid of losing her because he loved her so much, she completely softened. And she was like, oh, honey, I'm so sorry. I've been neglecting our relationship. You know, and the whole dynamic changed.
Yeah.
And so that's an example of like a misunderstanding that yeah. always happens.
And I know, man, listening to that story, when you got to that last part, when she finally saw what was going on, she said, oh, honey. A lot of guys never get that. They never hear the, oh, honey, that empathy, because security goes both ways. She must have had more security or stronger sense of self to be able to do that than to counterattack.
Well, I wouldn't. Oh, you see, at the end, yes, yeah, then to be able to counterattack. Yes, exactly. And he was able to finally, with me kind of coaching a bit, be vulnerable. And the way I define vulnerability, I steal from a colleague of mine, Annie Lala, which is vulnerability is just being emotionally honest. He was finally be able to talk about what was really going on, was that he was scared of losing the woman that he loved so much. And most men won't do that. They'll pretend they're tough. They're too afraid to show weakness because they've been told bullshit like it repels a potential mate, you know, if they've been in the dating industry for a while, or they've been reading dating advice for a while. When really securely attached women are drawn towards vulnerability. And there's a difference between vulnerability and then, you know, if you take it too far, you're in a complete needy mess.
Yeah, you were reading my mind, yeah.
Yeah, I know I was. Because I know what you teach too, and I wanted to make sure I wasn't countering what you teach.
There's a point at which a guy's vulnerability can become a burden to a woman. And I tell men, if your vulnerability to the point that you have no sense of self-sourcing, no sense of self-validation or self-approval, and you're looking to her 100% of the time for satisfaction and for validation, it becomes a tremendous burden on her. And yes, if she gets mad at you, that's a reason to get mad if somebody's dumping all their stuff on you. That's why I focus so much on self-reliance.
Yeah. Got it. And for the purpose of our conversation, I'm going to define vulnerability differently. You can't ever drive anybody away with vulnerability, because the way I define it is emotional honesty. Nobody's going to be driven away by honesty. It's when what you're talking about, that neediness, that desperation, that's not honest usually.
Yeah. It's emotional.
Those are protests. They're dishonest protests. Yeah.
Yeah. What did you call it? Dishonest protest?
Yeah. Yeah. Like instead of honestly saying, honey, I'm scared, I'm going to lose you, they're following their partner around like a child. It's another form of protest behavior, which we can talk about when we talk about attachment, but essentially it's dishonest. They're not talking about how they're truly feeling. They're trying to give their partner a hint, or passive aggressive is another way you may want to talk about it, instead of actually going, hey, you know what? I'm struggling. I need some help right now.
I love it. Radical honesty, right? I have a lot of guys read the book Radical Honesty to understand the power in being emotionally honest and making sure you're coming from a place of well-being instead of a place of passive aggressiveness trying to attack. It's beautiful, man. It's beautiful. Yeah, you told me that one of the foundations of everything you do has to do with connection. And you said, instead of trying to fix a couple's relationship problems by talking, I first help the couple feel safely connected like they did when they were falling in love. And only then does talking actually resolve anything. And this seems to be counter to traditional styles of therapy, right? Where communication is the only problem. So why is communication not effective without safe connection first?
Okay, great question. So quick, I'm gonna zoom out a little bit and give some context. So researchers show that relationships go through developmental stages, just like we grow up from being, you know, a newborn baby to a toddler to eventually a teenager and eventually a wise old man and a wise old woman. And you can't jump from toddler to wise old man or wise old woman. Your relationship can't jump stages, and it'll grow up in stages. And the first stage is the one we all know and love, the romance stage. We're high on drugs. Our brain's pumping out vasopressin, oxytocin, serotonin, all these lovely chemicals. And then anywhere between 6 months and 2 years, the chemicals stop being released by the brain. And we enter the power struggle stage, which is the second stage, which is where most couples who are stuck and are fighting either end up getting divorced or breaking up or stay stuck in, you know, an unsatisfying relationship. And if you're lucky enough to make it through the power struggle, you end up in the third and final stage, which is called mature love. And in mature love, you stop trying to change each other. You've accepted each other, warts and all. You can resolve conflict, repair disconnection, stay connected. Sexual intimacy, you're able to maintain it over the long term. So everybody wants to be in the mature love stage. Actually, I don't know if that's true. I think most people want to go back to the romance stage. But the unfortunate fact of the matter is that you can never go back to the romance stage. Once it's done for good. Yeah. And you've got to grow up. And the way you grow up is through the power struggle stage. Now, when we're in the power struggle stage, we begin to relate to each other like enemies. And our relationship starts to feel a little bit like a war zone. And just like you might be if you were walking through a minefield, you tiptoe around, kind of look, trying not to stand on a landmine. And if you thought you saw one, you'd yell at your partner, "Watch out!" You know, like you'd yell and scream just because you don't feel safe. That's what happens when our amygdala, the reptilian part of our brain that is designed to protect us and keep us alive, it can only do three things: fight, flight, or freeze. And so what happens in the power struggle stage is we don't feel safely connected to each other, so we relate like enemies. And then what most traditional marriage counselors will do, they'll teach these people communication skills. And the most common one is the I communication skill. So you go, "I feel," fill in the blank, or "when you do X, I feel Y." So it might be, "when you don't take out the trash, I feel hurt." But when you
kind of "you always" or "you never" type statements, right?
Exactly. It's designed to prevent that. Yeah. But what happens is when a couple's disconnected, they are not connected first, and they try and use a communication tool like that, it turns into, "when you don't take out the trash, I feel like you're just a freaking douchebag, asshole," you know? And now your communication tool has become a weapon that's better equipped you to further hurt your partner and damage your relationship. And this is why I often teach that communication tools are dangerous in disconnected hands, and that you have to get a couple connected first. And so what emotional connection means by my definition is you feel safe in the presence of your partner. You trust they're not going to abandon you. They're not going to reject you. They've got your back, and you can operate as a team together. They're on your side.
This is every guy's dream, every guy I talk to. Partnership, team, the word team comes up. I don't feel like she has my back. And she's always looking at the worst in me, or she always has me in low regard. What's an example of a couple that you got to break through, or how did you get a breakthrough from disconnection back to teamwork?
Well, good question. One of the things we can do is what we spoke about in your first question, which is once you identify the misunderstanding, often team is restored. That's one way. However, what often happens is in a relationship that's been emotionally neglected over years, you need to actually start filling up that emotional bank account again with deposits. Mm-hmm. And so I've got about 20 different connection, what I call connection rituals, that I help couples do. Like, I'll give you just a stupid, simple one. There's some research done in Germany in a German university that men who kissed their wives goodbye before going to work had 60% less chance of getting into a car accident and lived on average 5 years longer just kissing their spouse goodbye. And the reason for this is that physical touch, or what I call affectionate loving touch, soothes your nervous system. It stops the release of cortisol and creates the release of oxytocin, the cuddle hormone.
Yeah.
And when there's cortisol in your bloodstream, we do nothing well. Like literally human beings are not designed to function on cortisol unless you want to fight or you want to run like hell to protect your life. That's the function really of cortisol, is to keep you alive. Mm-hmm. But for everything else, particularly in a romantic relationship, you do not want cortisol in your bloodstream. And what you do want is oxytocin. And touch like this helps release the chemical oxytocin. So I'll get couples touching, like consciously making an effort for 2 or 3 times a day just to do loving, affectionate touch. Not sexual touch necessarily, but just loving, affectionate touch. That's one of 20 ways I'll use to get couples connected. Mm-hmm. And over time, as you add in all these different approaches together, within 2 weeks, a couple will usually report that they're feeling massively different about their partner, and the space between the two of them feels a lot warmer, and they naturally start to communicate kindly and lovingly in that warm space. So when a couple comes to me and says, please teach us some communication tools, I'm like, do you guys speak English? They look at me quizzingly, like they're like, yes. I'm like, okay, did you have any trouble communicating when you first fell in love? They're like, no, not at all. It's like, okay, so let me get this straight. You speak English and you know how to communicate, so why do you think you need communication tools? And they think they need communication tools because communication is the first symptom that they're disconnected. So the foundation of all my work could be kind of really summed up in 4 words. Connect first, communicate later. And that's what I help people do.
I love it. I love it. And it's like, yeah, you don't have a communication problem, you have a thinking problem. And with a lot of guys, what they walk around with every day is loads of negative thoughts and negative regard for their wife. They're assuming the worst. Yeah. They're assuming that she meant something she didn't. She's assuming she's doing something she shouldn't. She's talking to somebody she shouldn't. So the negative regard and the thoughts that come from that and the emotions that come after those thoughts, it sets you up for total failure. Communication, when it comes from that place, that scared, insecure, I call it the hummingbird place, it is never productive. And that's why I focus on a man becoming independent of her validation and approval so he can get strong enough to stand presently and vulnerably without fear, so you can communicate in a loving way instead of from fear and from doubt and skepticism.
Beautiful.
Which leads me to my next question. And in my last video where I introduced your name, it was a week ago, I think I introduced your name, it was about the play between independence, codependence, and interdependence. I use those 3 words, and I was looking forward to this interview with you so you can get a sense of what that is. I teach about healthy independence being a prerequisite to being able to be a giver, to be a selfless, agape-style lover. You use an analogy about a 3-legged race and relationship interdependence versus independence. I was wondering if you could talk more about that and what synchronization looks like when a couple's doing it well.
Okay, perfect. So I think I'm going to approach this question also from the 3 stages of relationship perspective, because, and I'm going to use my hands to demonstrate this. So when we're falling in love in the romance stage, when we first meet, you could think of this kind of dependence, what you might, or many people call codependence, which actually is in fact a word that comes from the addiction movement. It's actually not technically correct. I call it unhealthy dependence. And it's this idea that there's you, there's me, and we're bonded together and we're leaning on each other and we're dependent on each other. We rely on the other person to feel good about ourselves. And part of that is, that's completely normal. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It only becomes unhealthy when that stays that way and doesn't change. But it's actually the first part of falling in love. It's the way nature designed it. You're meant to fall in love and be dependent. And I'm a big advocate of promoting dependence, healthy dependence, because I believe that we are all dependent. It is not a choice, it's a fact. I mean, I'm dependent on, you know, the plumbing to flush my shit down the toilet and the plumber to unblock the toilet. I'm dependent on my maid to clean the house. I'm dependent on the road builders to build the roads that I drive my motorcycle on. You know, I'm dependent on the delivery guy to drive the fruit to the supermarket that I buy the fruit, you know, so you get the idea. So we're all dependent, and there's this idea that we shouldn't be dependent, and it's just absolute rubbish. So what happens is in the romance stage, we're dependent, but nature has no intention of keeping us dependent for the rest of our lives. So when we hit the power struggle stage and the drugs wear off, the goal of the power struggle stage is to establish our independence and our autonomy without losing the relationship. Now, if you become too independent, it looks like this, and suddenly you've got no people on the playing field anymore, no people on the dance floor dancing anymore. So you don't want to be so far apart. That's too much. There's this healthy balance between dependence and independence. And if you make it through the power struggle stage, then you enter the mature love stage, and this is what I call interdependence, which looks like this. It's this flex and flow where when, you know, you're in emotional trouble, the first thing you do is you go to your wife and say, honey, I'm having a bad day. I just need a hug. Can you give me a hug? And her, she gives you a hug, and suddenly you're like, oh, I feel so much better. Thank you. I love you. And off you go, and you feel better. And you, the technical term for this is other regulation. You regulate each other's emotional states in an interdependent way. Now, the metaphor that you were speaking about is what I call the three-legged race. But there's two of you together, and your legs are tied together, and you're kind of in this three-legged race, and you spoke about how do you synchronize that? Well, if you've ever been in an actual three-legged race, and I was in one a couple of years back on a beach Olympics, I remember I chose somebody to be my partner. They tied our ankles together, and the starting gun went off, and within 3 meters, we both ate dirt. We were totally unsynchronized, and boom, we were flattening our face in the sand, eating dirt. And it took us a couple of goes of practicing and falling on our face first before we learned how to both of us move that middle leg at the same time. As one, exactly. And I think that's what the power struggle is. It's falling on your face. That's normal. And what synchronization looks like is not necessarily just being a team around everyday practical tasks around the house, like sharing household or child-rearing responsibilities, but it's about being an emotionally supportive team, Steve. So it's about providing support in two forms, when your partner's up and when your partner's down. When your partner's up, you're cheerleading. You're going, go, you can do it. I'm your biggest fan. You know, go and get that promotion. Go and, you know, learn how to play guitar. You're supporting your partner's individuation, which is essentially what this process is. It's the process of individuating. And you're supporting their personal goals, the goals that don't even include you, the goals that are separate from you. You support them spending time with their friends. You support them going away for weekends with their guy friends or their girlfriends or whatever friends. You support what they want for themselves and their life, even if it's not what you would want for yourself. That's the support part. That's a cheerleading part. The support part, should I say, is when they're down. You jump and you catch them and you help them when they need support. The idea that two of you are stronger than one when you're operating in synchrony. You're both probably weaker than one when you're not operating in synchrony or in sync. So it's this idea of you're there to lift your partner up when they're down, and you're there to cheer them on when they're up, and you're supporting both their individual goals as well as your joint relationship goals. So couples in the mature love stage who've mastered this interdependent idea tend to have a vision for their relationship as well as visions for their individual lives. And the research shows that couples in the mature love stage actually behave more autonomously than couples who are single. Than people who are single, but couples that are single. People who are single. So that people in mature love stage relationships tend to have more self-confidence, the ability to go out there and do things that they wouldn't have done if they were single, because they know they've got somebody to come home to. If the shit hits the fan and it all goes wrong, they've got their partner support. They've got a team behind them backing them up. And it seems to be, or at least that's how the theory goes, that this understanding or felt sense that I have a team, I'm not on my own, gives people more courage to go out into the world and take bigger risks in their careers and their lives, like that. So a couple of ways to be emotionally in sync or supportive or interdependent. I love Dr. Susan Johnson from the Ottawa University in Canada. She has a great acronym, A-R-E-R, standing for available, responsive, and engaged. And these interdependent couples are available to each other should the other person need support. They're responsive when their partner reaches out. Remember Mandy and Jay I spoke about in the beginning with a broken chair? Yeah. Well, Mandy wasn't responsive, and so Jay got very insecure. She would just dismiss him. Securely attached couples are responsive to each other. When one partner, it looks like they're in distress, the other one drops what they're doing, goes, hey, honey, what's up? Are you okay? What's going on? What do you need? How can I support you? Kind of thing. And then they're engaged. That's the A-R-E. The E part is engaged. When their seated partner is in distress, they drop what they're doing and they engage fully. They're fully present, is the way you might describe it to your men. And they're engaged in each other's challenges and processes. and they support each other. So it was a long answer to a short question, but that's how I would think of creating that synchrony.
So I just wanted to hear you talk, because when I said that you're pragmatic and clear, but you have depth of nuance and intellect, this is exactly what I wanted my guys to hear from you, is all these analogies that are so clear with plain language. I just love it. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you. You're good for my ego.
Oh, good. I'm here to support you, brother. I'm here to celebrate you.
Thank you, my friend.
Man, you know, I have a men's meetup. I meet every 2 weeks here in Fort Collins, and a lot of the guys are getting into some reading. A lot of them are reading about attachment theory. They've read Hold Me Tight by Dr. Sue Johnson, and they're really starting to try to understand what attachment styles mean and how it showed up in their marriage or divorce. And I was wondering if you could spend a few minutes explaining what the different attachment styles look like and sound like, and how do you identify a couple that has attachment issues?
Okay, got it. So let's start by quickly creating a working definition of attachment. So attachment is the study of how we bond with our significant others. It starts off with how we bond with our parents when we're children, and then the study matured into how we bond with relationship partners, with our romantic partners, and they discovered the same dynamics that mother and child relationships display are displayed between husband and wife, or, you know, partner A and partner B if you're in a same-sex relationship. And the strategies we learned as children to get our parents' attention and love and to feel safe and attached are the same strategies we use as adults. And often we never outgrow our childlike strategies. I'm not going to go into history, because there's a lot. You can just Google attachment theory on and you'll find a ton of stuff. So it's essentially the study of how we bond. And depending on which researcher you read, and there are many, you will discover that there are anywhere between 3 and 6 different attachment styles. I use the 6 attachment style model, but for the sake of brevity, I'm just going to share the 3 attachment style model. Attachment style number 1, you're securely attached to your partner. What that means is that you trust that your partner's there for you, they have their back, and you can count on them. You're comfortable reaching out to them for support and saying, honey, help, I need you. Or, honey, can you just tell me that you love me? I'm feeling a little bit low. Like, that's just a comfort, you know, a standard thing for secure attached people. They have no shame or discomfort doing that. And when your partner's in distress, you're completely comfortable with them depending on you for as long as they need to depend on you. Obviously, as long as it doesn't become unhealthily dependent, you're absolutely available for them to support them, and they're available for you. That's a securely attached relationship dynamic.
Got it.
Second attachment style is called anxiously attached. And anxiously attached people, I call the hailstorm. They tend to be anxious about their bond with their partner. And they usually grew up in families where their comfort was inconsistent. So at some point, comfort was there. And at other times, it wasn't. So maybe baby's crying. Mommy picks up the baby, rocks the baby. Baby is soothed, and baby learns, oh, it feels so good. Mom just took away my pain, because babies can't take away their own pain. And then the next time, mom didn't come and just left baby to cry. In my case, my mom told me she read that book. I forget the name of the author, who in the 70s wrote this book encouraging parents to leave their children to cry. Otherwise, they'd become dependent. Of course, one of the worst books ever written for parenting. And that's how my mom parented me. Sometimes her natural desire was to want to nurture me. But then sometimes she'd go, no, I don't want to make Bruce dependent on me. She'd just leave me to cry. And that uncertainty about whether or not mom would be available to me to comfort me when I was in distress created anxious attachment to me. I became hypervigilant about monitoring 2 things: mom's emotional availability and mom's physical proximity. How close or far mom was from me physically, like in the next room. And if I cried, would she come or would she just ignore me? And if she ignored me, I mean, I don't remember this, but this is what anxiously attached kids do. They wail, temper tantrum. You know, as a kid, you don't have any language to go, help, mom, I'm feeling insecure about whether or not you're there for me. You don't have that cognitive ability. What you do have, though, is the ability to make a noise. So these kids make a noise. On the other hand, those are the hailstorms, the anxiously attached kids. They grow up into adults who have a lot of difficulty in relationships. They have a fear of abandonment, and they tend to chase their partner and attract partners who tend to not be available for them consistently or at all. And it makes them very insecure, and they have these very dramatic relationships that leave them feeling very unsatisfied, and they're often come across as critical, angry, demanding, needy. That's the hailstorm.
Gotcha. So that's secure attachment and then anxious attachment.
Exactly. Anxious attachment, I nickname the hailstorm. Now we've got the third type, which is called avoidant attachment, which I nickname the turtle, because these people retreat into their shells like a turtle does, and they don't stick their head out until they feel safe again. They're gone. And these turtles come from families where there was no comforting at all. The kids were just left alone in their distress and with absolutely no ability to turn off their difficult feelings, whether it was they had a dirty nappy, whether it was they had an upset stomach, whether it was they were afraid. If nobody came to help them, a child is completely unable to soothe itself. In fact, there's more and more evidence to suggest that as adults, what we call self-soothing is impossible. Human beings cannot soothe themselves. Everything that we think of as self-soothing is in fact some form of using something else to soothe us, like a guitar soothes me, or using meditation to soothe us. We're always using something to soothe us. This idea that we can soothe ourselves, some scientists are saying it's actually a misnomer. It doesn't exist. Self-soothing is not something that we can do. But parents think the child must learn to soothe themselves, and or the parents are completely uncomfortable with emotional displays and don't know what to do. So the child learns nobody's going to come and support me through my difficult times. And so what happens is the child has no way to stop the pain, almost like having your fingers stuck in an electrical socket and being electrocuted without any way of being able to pull your finger out. That's what happens to these kids. So they only have one choice available to them, and that's to numb themselves.
Got secure, you've got the hailstorm, and then the turtle, or the insecure.
Avoidant. Insecure, avoidant, insecure, anxious, and then secure. And so these turtles numb themselves inside, Steve, and they can't feel anything. And that's what allows them to retreat into their shell, almost as if they're feelingless. They don't feel anything, so they can withdraw. Their attachment system is switched off, and their desire to bond is switched off. And that's what allows them to be able to retreat, whereas insecurely attached people, they can't do that. And neither can insecure, anxiously attached people. They can't do that. Their attachment system on the anxious side is almost hyper on, whereas on the turtle side, on the avoidant side, the attachment system's, the desire to bond is turned off. And so they retreat. And the more this turtle retreats, the more terrified of abandonment the hailstorm becomes, and the more they chase. And the more the turtle chases, the more terrified this turtle becomes of engulfment or rejection. Turtles or avoidantly attached people are terrified of engulfment or rejection. So they retreat more. And you can see this vicious cycle goes round and round until they end up broken up with divorce.
It's really bad. You know. And it's always the anxiously attached person that feels the most distress. Turtles tend to get away from the stress by hiding, and they don't feel quite the anxiety that the pursuer does. I wrote an article called The Pursuer Distancer Dynamic for the Gottman blog a while back.
Yeah.
And it's that same thing. And what's unfair, it feels unfair to the anxiously attached person that they have more effect over this dynamic than the turtle does by stopping the pursuit and changing some behavior first to get started.
Exactly.
And so we're looking at metaphors. The mountain lion hummingbird thing, the mountain lion is the securely attached person. The hummingbird is the anxious attached. And just to use cross-reference our metaphors.
Exactly. So one of your questions was, what does it sound like? What do these styles sound like? We've spoken a little bit of what they look like. Well, I've written like 20-page descriptions of each of them in my private members area of my coaching program. And the top of every description, I have a little quote. And the hailstorm's quote is, do you love me? Mm. Like, this is what hailstorms sound like inside. Like, I don't think you love me. They're hyper-obsessed with whether or not their partner's going to be there for me. Or are you there for me? Or will you be there for me? Or are we okay? Or my favorite, how are you feeling, honey? That's what hailstorms say all the time. They don't give a damn about how their partner's feeling because they're concerned about their partner. They're concerned about the state of their bond, and they're trying to soothe their own anxiety by making sure their partner's okay, so that they feel okay. Not so that their partner feels okay, but so that they feel okay. But the quote for the turtle is, I need some space. And the turtle dives into the shell, just, I need some space. Time out, right? That's the turtle's motto. And that's what they kind of sound like. And then the next question you asked me was, how do I identify couples who have insecure attachment or attachment issues? Well, there are 10 kind of warning signs or signals. And I've got them. I just brought up the file in front of me just to read them out to you. I'll quickly read them out to you. You regularly feel unappreciated, misunderstood, unsafe, or alone. It's a sign you're in an insecurely attached relationship. It feels dangerous to share your vulnerable feelings with your partner because you'll probably end up in a fight. You can't just count on your partner to just listen to you and feel heard. It feels like there's a constant tension between the two of you. Small disagreements quickly escalate into blowout fights for no apparent reason that are way out of proportion with the actual initial offense. You're tiptoeing around the eggshells, too afraid to communicate how you're really feeling for fear of sparking another fight. Sex has become less and less frequent. The passion that you first felt has turned into familiarity, and perhaps you feel more like brother and sister than lovers. Your relationship has become cold, with both of you shutting down and pretending that you no longer need each other. That's kind of towards the end of the relationship. That's just pre-breakup. And then you're stuck in a dynamic where one of you withdraws, which is the turtle, and the other one chases, which is the hailstorm. Those are the 10 warning signs. And what I say to my couples is, if you have any one of those, let alone 2, 3, 4, 5, it's pretty safe to say you're in the power struggle stage and your relationship is in potential danger and you need to do something about it.
Yeah. Do you mind if I hone in on just one of those 10? Sex one, this comes up all the time. The old adage is that women need to feel emotionally connected to have sex and men need sex to feel emotionally connected. What do you say to a man, or what might you say to a man who's listening to you talking and going, you know what, I wouldn't be so damn insecurely attached if she would just give me more sex. That's the problem here. We're having no sex and that's the problem.
Yeah.
And this is a common thing, right? How do you respond to that?
I say that's not the problem. The problem is secure attachment. On a foundation, the reason why she doesn't want to have sex is because she feels anxious and she doesn't feel like he's on her side, on her team. She would call it emotional connection. That's how she would frame it in her head. But the truth of the matter is that she's scared. She's scared that the relationship isn't stable. And because she's scared, her amygdala, fight or flight, is activated. And in that space of fight or flight, we are designed not to fuck. We're designed to run or fight. You don't have sex in a war zone. You run, right?
Beautiful.
It's not, you know, I think it's a bit confusing. And he wants to obviously feel connected. The way he feels connected first is to have sex. And often turtle men, this is particularly for avoidantly attached men who struggle to feel their feelings, the one domain they do feel secure in is in the bedroom. And so they want to open up sexually first so that they feel safe. And in that space after sex, they can open up emotionally. And so I actually bypass that whole thing and I focus on the relationship first, because he's focusing on me. I need sex first, then I can be connected. She's focusing on her. I need connection first, then I can have sex. It's all about me, what I need. It's not about the relationship.
Yeah.
So one of the tricks is to get the couple focused on what the relationship needs, almost like you would if you had a baby together. You'd put your needs aside for what's good for the relationship, and you'd nurture the relationship first. And what the relationship needs first is to not be under threat.
Yeah.
Because the minute the relationship's under threat, it's like having a knife at the relationship's throat. It's going to, you know, trigger the amygdala, and there's no way either any of you are going to end up in the bedroom and being intimate when you're scared of each other.
Yeah.
So you've got to remove fear first and replace it with safety and security. Now, safety and security is not the same as that boring comfort that kills sexual desire. Safety and security is a fundamental requirement in order to have good sex. If you don't have safety and security, you can't drop your guard and really just be free to let go and be you in the bedroom and express all sides of you. You'll be anxious about, are they going to judge me? Are they going to reject me? Are they going to look at my belly and see my fat and, like, you know, not want to be with me? All that stuff will be running through your head when you don't feel safe.
I love it. I've got to get a quote, a frame quote of, we're not designed to fuck when we're anxious. Like I said, that they could fuck in a bomb, in a bombing scene, they could still fuck. But one thing you also said, that when the turtle guy or the avoidant attached guy, the turtle guy is feeling like the only road to connection and intimacy is through intercourse, through sexual activity.
Yeah.
One of the things that you and I both teach is how liberated you feel when you understand that intimacy beyond just sexual intercourse, intellectual, you know, emotional and spiritual intimacy. This conversation you and I are having right now, two dudes, right? This is a very intimate, vulnerable, open, satisfying, you know, fulfilling discussion. And it, guys, when guys learn this, they learn that they take the pressure off needing to have sex and orgasm when they find out when they become vulnerable and securely attached and a little bit more independent in their emotions, they can take pleasure in the conversation and the process. Yeah. And it's really intimate in many ways. And once she sees that he's confident there, all of a sudden the sexual gates open up again.
Exactly. And once, what will get him confident there, part of what gets him confident there is knowing the relationship isn't under threat. So that's why I say it's the foundation. And Dr. Sue Johnson says, secure attachment is the ultimate aphrodisiac. And the way I see it, because you've got Esther Perel on the other side who talks about how, you know, desire requires distance. Desire requires, whereas love requires closeness. Desire requires uncertainty, whereas love wants certainty. And she talks about how you need to stop doing the things that promote love in order to promote desire if you're doing too much of the love stuff. And you've got to create this balance between the two. And I agree. But if you are insecurely attached, if the foundation of secure attachment isn't there, you won't be able to allow your partner the distance, the uncertainty, because you'll be too afraid it'll end the relationship. So you'll be constantly chasing. So you've got to first create that foundation of secure attachment. Then once you feel safe, you can say to your partner, go off and, you know, for the weekend with your buddies and I'll see you next week. And when we come back, we'll have a good time. Or whatever it is, or allow them to explore those two polarities that.
Some healthy sexual tension.
Yeah.
Last time we spoke, you mentioned the difference between secrecy and privacy, and I wanted to talk about that briefly today because there is so much anxiety these days about what your spouse is doing when she's not with you or he's with you, who they're talking to, who they're going out with, girls' night out, Facebook, Instagram, always on her damn phone. I see that she talked to some dude for a half hour last weekend looking at her phone records. And so it made me think, I want to know what Bruce has to say about secrecy versus privacy and how it feeds the insecure or secure level of attachment in a relationship.
Okay, perfect. So privacy is essential in a relationship. Couples who get stuck in this, what you call codependence, what I call unhealthy dependence, what Ellen Bader, famous couples researcher, would call this merged state of,
the enmeshment.
Thank you. The enmeshment. She has another name for it, but that's just as good. The enmeshed stage is you lose who you are. And this is when couples who are stuck here, they say things like, I've forgotten who I am in this relationship. I feel like I've lost myself. That's because they've never individuated healthily in the power struggle stage. And individuated couples who say, I feel like we've lost the relationship and I've lost my feelings. They've individuated too much in the power struggle stage. And part of, Steve, I lost my train of thought. Remind me your question again.
It was secrecy versus privacy.
Oh, that's it. Exactly. Thank you. So part of what creates a healthy independence is having your own private life, things that are uniquely for you. So for me, this is my friends. They might be ex-girlfriends that I stay in touch with. They might be guy friends. It's my guitar. It's my meditation practice. It's me traveling on my own back to South Africa to go visit my family. It's my private life, some of which I'll share with her, but some of which I won't include with her. And that's fine. It's not a threat to our relationship. And you actually want to promote and support your partner's private life so that you're both healthy, individuated, so that one of you doesn't one day wake up and go, you know what? I've lost who I am. I'm done with you. Goodbye. What happens is after a betrayal of trust or somebody's very insecure from, you know, a previous relationship or just from their childhood, they'll be constantly unsure, certain that their partner is going to be there for them, and they'll try to almost pry or control their partner's privacy. And that's healthy boundaries need to be set there. Like, that's got to stop. And, you know, particularly after an affair, when the partner who's been cheated on goes, I want to see everything on your phone. I want to read your emails. And I'm like, no, you can't do that. And the reason you can't do that is that, A, it's an invasion of your partner's privacy. And what we're trying to do here is rebuild trust, not destroy it even further. And B, what I've discovered is that it only makes you feel worse. The person who's been betrayed, who's been cheated on, when they read all that stuff, because they want to know every last detail, it never makes them feel better. It only ever makes them feel worse. They read it, and then they just want to know more. And if they're afraid that their partner's cheating, they say, give me your phone, I want proof. They go through their partner's phone, they can't find any proof because their partner's innocent. But it just makes them more convinced that their partner is just hiding it. Mm-hmm. And now they become hyper-vigilant. And so they've got to learn to just stop and give their partner trust. Because if their partner's going to cheat on them again, there is nothing they can do to stop that. That's going to happen anyway. I don't know if that answered your question, but
that's the way I think about it. Secrecy versus privacy. There's the boundary issues. Where do you draw the line? And you answered that for me. I know we could spend forever on that question, and we're going to be running out of time here. I want to ask this last question because it gets to what I work on as well, and that is a lot of times you have a relationship to one person is so checked out, they don't want to talk to Bruce Music or Steve Horsman about communication problems or connection problems. They don't want to dive into the depths and the nuance of psychology and amygdalas and all that crap. They want nothing to do with it. But there's one person who does, and you, in your 7-week course, you said that you can start improving a relationship even if you're the only one working on it, which I agree with. How do you explain that? How is that possible to do?
Well, Steve, I'm actually even bolder than that. I say you can completely turn your relationship around and resolve your relationship challenges many times, not all the time, but many times on your own, single-handedly. And how that's possible is that a relationship's a little bit like a seesaw. And, you know, if you have a seesaw and there's two people in the seesaw and you've got to do this balancing act, you know, if one person's dominating the relationship or one person's constantly not getting their needs met, the seesaw's going to stay stuck like this. And when the seesaw stops moving, the relationship is in trouble. And as you, let's say you're on this side, as you start shifting your weight here a little bit, take a little bit of space, the seesaw starts to balance out again. And your partner's forced to respond differently as you bring a different view to the relationship. So that's the overarching principle. Now, how that actually works in practical reality is that the reason why your partner shut down or your relationship's in trouble is because your partner's not having a need met. They have a very important need. They may not be able to necessarily name it, but there's a need that's going unmet. And that need is so vital to them that without having it met by you, they feel dead inside. Here's the interesting thing about relationship dynamics that I don't think many personal development teachers understand. There are certain needs that can only be met by another person and that only come online in a romantic attachment bond relationship. Okay, the need for comfort, the need for tender affectionate touch, the need to feel like your partner has your back and supports you. All these things are relational needs. They don't exist. You don't need to feel like your partner has your back when you're single because you don't have a partner. You don't need to feel tender touch when you're single because, you know, you're not expecting your partner to touch you. And you can't meet them yourself. Try touching yourself. Not the same as when your partner strokes you. Try having sex with yourself. It's not the same as when you have sex with your partner. Try hugging yourself. Not the same as when your partner hugs you. It doesn't have that soothing quality to it. So we're dependent on our partners to meet these needs. And when these needs go unmet for so long, we feel dead inside and we feel alone in the relationship. So the first thing you got to do is you've got to start identifying your partner's needs, begin meeting them like a motherfucker. And what happens is once you meet them over time, your partner melts, they soften, they learn to trust. The first reaction though, when you start meeting them, your partner's probably going to push back and go, a little bit too late now, hey? And now that I'm about to leave you, you want to meet my needs.
Yeah.
And particularly
if the partner's now, why couldn't you do it 10 years ago?
Yeah, why couldn't you do it 10 years ago? And that's the hardest part for the partner who's now suddenly woken up because they're completely on board now. Suddenly they want to give their partner everything and they authentically do. And the partner who wanted it for so long is now ambivalent. And they're like, yeah, I don't know. You've got to stick at it. It will happen. The seesaw might be a bit rusty. And it needs to creak, 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 creak back into balance. But it will much of the time. Sometimes it's too late. Relationships also have a tipping point after which it's too late. But you know, I've even seen, I had a couple that were divorced and they came to me and ended up getting remarried again. So, you know, you never know.
The business partner who does the training with me, he is dating his ex-wife now.
There you go.
They're having the conversations now they always wish they could have had. It's beautiful.
Oh, I love it.
Well, Bruce, I want to thank you for being here. This is such a treat, and I just appreciate your wisdom and the way you communicate it. And I'm going to be sharing this with everybody that I know. And I just wanted to ask you, if somebody wants to get a hold of you or find out more about you, what's the best way you have for people to get in touch with you?
Sure. Go to www.loveatfirstfight.com. And there I give away a free relationship course. It's a 1 week relationship help course that you can get for free. We'll get a ton of tools. You get to kind of test drive the kind of work that I do. I send out useful emails, and kind of like Steve's emails are always really, really useful. And whenever I get an email from you, Steve, I always want to read it because it's packed with value. We have a similar philosophy on sending out emails.
Yeah, serve. I think that's why we get along. We both give it a big shit. We both care a lot, and nothing else happens. We just want to serve these guys. So I hope you guys got a lot out of this. Bruce, again, thank you so much.
And thank you for having me.
I will talk to you again soon. Guys, enjoy this. Enjoy the TED Talk that I mentioned earlier. Go find him, and we'll see you later. Bye-bye.
See you later. Thanks, Steve.